You're listening to Love and Revolution Radio, covering the heart of change and changes at the heart, featuring stories of ordinary, extraordinary people waging struggle for love and revolution. This week on Love and Revolution Radio, we speak with author Terry Patton about his book, A New Republic of the Heart, an Ethos for Revolutionaries. Needups, Needupesks, Aguanu, hello and welcome. This is Sherry Mitchell for Love and Revolution Radio, and I'm coming to you from Wabanaki territory here in the Dawn Land in my own territory, Penobscot territory, located in and along the shorelines of the beautiful Penobscot River in central Maine. And I'm joined today by my amazing co-host, Miss Rivera Sun. Hi, Rivera.
Greetings, Sherry. It's good to be on the airwaves again with you. We do have an extra guest on our show today. There's a cricket in my earship out here in New Mexico who is chirping loud and clearly, and it sounds like it's about to keep it up for the whole show. I might have to do a bit of a cricket catch-and-release program in the next few weeks because it seems like they're trying to do the audio equivalent of photobombing our radio show. So bear with Jiminy out there, and we'll get on with our real guest for today, Terry Patton, who I'm delighted to have on the show. He is an author that thinks a lot about that connection between the inner and the outer, the personal and the political, the spiritual and the cultural. He has been speaking and consulting internationally as a community organizer, a philosopher, and teacher for a number of decades. He spent the last 15 years working on the integral project of evolving consciousness and healing our global crises through spirit-based activism. Listeners to Love and Revolution Radio will know that that is a common theme for Sherry and I. And Terry is also involved in some tangible projects like restorative redwood forestry, creating alternatives to fossil fuels, and building up sustainable economies. Sounds like, Terry, you could definitely be on our show on a number of different issues, but we're going to start this week with talking about your new book. Welcome to the show.
Well, thanks so much. I'm delighted to be here. I immediately recognized that this was a kindred opportunity when I just looked at the title, Love and Revolution. Exactly so. We're in a moment that is revolutionary, and love is the only engine of survival in the time ahead.
Well, I don't know about you, but for me, looking around at these times, it can be so daunting and intimidating. The idea that we could live in and through, hopefully, a revolutionary time period is actually quite an adventure in life. It's much better for my personality type that likes to have adventures than, you know, business as usual, life as usual, the white picket fence and the two kids and the dog. Not that dogs and kids aren't, you know, they're pretty good. But if you can have a little revolutionary fun in there, I'm all for it. So, Terry, in the intro to your new book, you wrote about the quandary and the struggle you were having grappling with the reality of not just the climate crisis, but the many entwined crises that contribute to that and are aggravated by the climate crisis, and your dark night of the soul, not knowing which way this story is going to turn. Would you speak a little bit about that and what got you into the path of writing this book, A New Republic of the Heart?
Well, I was raised in an intentional community founded by members of the Church of the Brethren, one of the peace churches in America, who invited people of other races and religions to live together with them as a witness for peace and brotherhood. So I was kind of raised by a whole group of co-op aunts and uncles who were civil rights and peace activists, and so I was kind of bred to be an activist and was that in my earliest life. But then I had a recognition that the revolution really had to begin with me. And so I spent the first half of my adult life living in an ashram and involved in pretty intensive 24/7 spiritual practice. And I think all through that, I had a recognition that somehow wisdom was being called forward, that we were in a critical time. But I didn't see it with 2020 vision until gradually over time I saw the slow motion train wreck that is before us now. And in the last several years, we've seen an intensifying of particularly measurably global warming, the ecological destruction of the planet, the severity and extremity and urgency of our relationship to our whole living planet, which is the essence of everything healthy and holy and happy in every single one of us and in all our communities. So my sense of urgency just sharpened and sharpened. And as I did my research, because, you know, at first I was looking at this as a book about spiritual activism, but you can't speak about that in a vacuum. You have to speak about it in relation to what's really happening on the planet. And as I took in with kind of growing horror the extreme nature of the moment that we're in and the degree of denial that almost everybody is in, myself included. If you're a social creature living in a society that's in denial, you can't help but be in denial yourself. But, you know, waking from that really took me through quite a dark night of the soul, and not just one. It's been a series of new, deeper levels of reckoning. But oddly enough, after each one, I've had another period of revelation that's opened my heart to another sense of the joy and meaning of forging forward in love, even in the midst of the extreme urgency of our time. So that might give you a sense of where I'm coming from.
Terry, there are so many things in your book that really remind me of the work that I'm doing in the world, the work that Revere is doing in the world, and the basic ethos that we operate from within, even though our backgrounds are all very distinct. There's, commonality within the diversity of our positions. One of the things that you talk about in your book is how activism strives for a wholeness in our social relations, our political and economic systems, our institutions, and our structures of power. And I like how you say, once we become attuned to wholeness, we can begin to see it showing up everywhere around us. And once we seriously commit to and intentionally orient ourselves toward wholeness, we can embody a deliberately more inclusive and expansive approach to every aspect of our lives. We can cultivate a more wholesome and essential relationship to life. We can evaluate our actions by more holistic standards. We can create new practices, unfold new strategies, and form new organizations explicitly oriented toward emergent wholeness. Then you say this evolution of human nature can be nurtured by an integral practice that combines inner work with altruistic service and action in the world. I would love for you to tell our listeners a little bit about that integral work that you're talking about. You call it an integral impulse, and those who express it, integralists. And I just really like the way that you frame that and put that together. So could you tell our listeners a little bit about your own integral practice and how you become an integralist by actually engaging that practice out in the world?
Well, there are so many different ways of talking about it. I'll see what comes forward in this moment. In a sense, you know, the word integral has two connotations. One of them is like integrity or integer, and really refers to wholeness. And the other is related to words like integration and integrating. And that more or less relates to all the parts. And when you bring a new part into something that was missing, the whole changes in order to allow the parts to come in. And I think my process of growth has repeatedly been one in which I've woken up to some measure of what is real in the world that really hadn't been accounted for by the society I grew up in and by our common shared world. And I've integrated some aspect of reality, or I've integrated some aspect of myself, my own shadow, my fear. I've grown to have compassion for parts of myself that I previously had been trying to bury or exclude with contempt. The process, though, of using that word came out of process of work with Ken Wilber and other people at the Integral Institute. Ken has a pretty huge international reputation as the kind of the dean of integral philosophers, and his work has integrated a lot of Western scientific and philosophical traditions with great Eastern spiritual traditions in a quite stupendous theoretical integration. And my honor and opportunity was to work with him to translate that abstract philosophical view into a way of life that you could actually live. And Integral Life Practice, the book I co-authored with Ken and Marco Morelli and Adam Leonard, expresses that way of life. And I've been teaching integral practice for about 15 years based on that. And the way I practice it is, it varies to some degree. What it really recognizes is that every moment of life is a practice, whether you know it or not. You're always practicing something because, as the neuroscientist Donald Hebb said, neurons that fire together wire together. So however you're neurons are firing right now, they're making it more likely that they'll fire in similar patterns in the future. So you might be practicing distractibility, you might be practicing anxiety, resentment, whatever is going on with you, boredom, you know, you're practicing it, and you're going to be more likely to be anxious or bored or whatever in some future moment. So beginning to recognize that we have a responsibility in every moment in terms of where we put our attention and the attitudes and the qualities of mind with which we direct our attention. They're always a way of crafting the future self that's going to show up in another moment and be more of a source of wholeness and health and joy and community or less. So this recognition that all of life is a practice, and that in a way that extends in all of our shared lives, are a form of practice. Like we're just encountering each other, but there's already at least a tacit sense of common ground and goodwill. And yet the more we deepen into a felt apprehension of the perilous nature, the precarious nature of the lives we're living right now, and the fact that the things that are actually the biggest challenges in each of our personal lives are things we share, I think a kind of softening of the heart comes forward, and a curiosity. Are you really here with me? Can I be really here with you? What is it like for you? How are you making it through this? How could I help you? How can you help me? How is it for us to be human together? And that's a kind of shared practice. When humans soften into real contact with one another, we're beginning to become a different kind of we. And that's something I talk about a lot in my book.
I was just going to note that. That was one of the interesting sections for me, is how you went from life as a practice and the individual kind of rewiring of our neurons to then thinking of that collectively and socially in our movements for change. And we do think about that when we say the catchphrases like be the change, walk the talk, build the new in the shell of the old, or even live the revolution into existence, pray with your feet. All of these are really about connecting those inner and outer dots, but also understanding that nobody's going to hand us the change on the silver platter, that whether you're looking at things that are might fall in the realm of lifestyle activism or collective action, such as boycotts or strikes, all of the changes that we're looking at really are about being the switchboard operator on the switchboard of the universe and unplugging the old system and rewiring it to the way that we want to be in the world. So one thing that interested me very much in what you were writing about is you did speak about the news story, which we've spoken to our listeners about before on the show, and how we're rewiring our meta narratives of what it means to be human on this earth. But you took a special focus on stories of transition. And that interested me a lot as a novelist, someone who writes fictional stories that deal with nonviolent struggles or people on the verge of change, groups who are going through upheaval and evolutionary leaps forward, or crisis and potential collapse. I'd love to hear you speak more about why the story of transition and stories of a transition are so vitally important to us right now.
Well, we're in a what I call in the book a tipping point, and it's a tipping point that has, you know, they're both very, very frightening and very inspiring things that are developing in our world that are, you know, in the current lingo, disruptive. Disruptive means it changes everything. Just like Amazon disrupted the whole industry of publishing and bookstores. There are many things that will disrupt the world that we're in right now, one way or another. Now, some of them we can predict, like extreme weather events. There really are going to be amazing hurricanes and other kinds of superstorms that are going to make what formerly were, you know, 1,000-year floods into more frequent occurrences, or horrible wildfires like we've had near where I live, or killer droughts, or killer heat waves, or desertification of big areas that force large numbers of people to migrate. Those are disruptive events, and they reach a certain critical mass. Insurance industries aren't able to cover the losses. We have governments trying to cover for them, or financial institutions. We have financial crashes. The crash itself is disruptive. Those are negative. But if you have a technological breakthrough that actually makes fossil fuels non-competitive, and suddenly you don't have to be emitting all this carbon into the atmosphere, or if you had a scientific breakthrough that would allow you to begin to precipitate carbon from the atmosphere on a large scale affordably, or if you were able to transform the ways communities interact such that the famously difficult process of building effective, happy, loving community became way easier and way more widespread, and we began to have a new kind of politics arise. Any one of those things would very positively disrupt our future, and any one of them could spread very rapidly and create all kinds of things that we hope for. And we're in a moment in which these enormously transformative possibilities lie before us. If you kind of look ahead, you turn your gaze to the left and look at the best possible alternatives, you know, we might be so privileged to be alive at a turning point for the whole trajectory of the evolution of life on this planet, when in our lives we can make a difference and help bring about some truly glorious futures that are almost beyond imagination in terms of how utopian they might be. But you turn your head to the other side, look all the way to the right, you look at the most negative of the options, and you might be recognizing that you and I could be having this conversation in one of the last moments of calm before a real falling apart of human civilization that would, you know, perhaps not just kill us, but perhaps even destroy the whole evolution of human culture that we know. And we could be degenerating into a Mad Max dystopian future, and perhaps even human extinction. And every possibility in between those extremes is also no longer unimaginable. And what happens in our lifetimes matters so much and will determine in one way or another which direction things will go. And even though we're each just one person among billions, and even though in some sense we often feel powerless, there is a way that the decision-making power of this human collective resides in it's distributed. Some measure of what will determine that future is right there in the chair you're sitting in, and in the one I'm sitting in. Each one of us has a chance to make a difference, and somehow that's really intense to grasp. You know, you on one level, you might get very, you know, kind of frozen with a sense of sober responsibility and feel like you have the weight of the world on your shoulders. But of course, if we're to really do our best, we have to find a way to find joy and lightheartedness. You know, things are far too serious for us to lose our sense of humor. It's our joy, it's our love, it's our playfulness, it's our lightheartedness that brings forth many of our best qualities. So we find ourselves in an awe-inspiring, paradoxical situation that just pierces me to the heart, and I want to be with other caring souls who are also pierced to the heart and who can together contemplate what all of this is, how what it means, how we can show up in a way that reflects what's truest and best and most beautiful about us and about life.
The story that you just shared reminds me of a dream guide that I have had my whole life. I have someone who comes to me in my dreams ever since I was a small child and walks with me and discusses some of the things that are going on in my life with me and helps to guide me in many ways, but mostly listens and directs a shift in the focus. And one of the things that has happened in the last 10 years that was really profound for me was me going on and on and on in a dream about how I wanted to know that I was doing the right thing, that the work that I was doing was effective, that I wasn't wasting my time here, that I was actually contributing something that was going to help shift humanity back toward life. And this dream guide listened to the whole discussion. And then when I was done, turned to me and said, "Have you asked yourself what you're working so hard to protect if you have no joy in your life?" And so when we think about the work, we often get caught up in the details, and we get caught up in trying to resolve all of these challenges and conflicts that we're coming up against. And we forget the simple pleasures in life, the simple things that bring us joy. And we have to remember that at the heart of all of the work that we're doing is this sense of joyfulness and love for the lives and the life of creation that we're working to protect. So I really connected when you were talking about joy because it reminded me of that story. I want to talk to you a little bit about this concept of the brain of humanity waking up. Within our oral traditions, from my own tribal background, we have stories that talk about ancestral memory being stored within our DNA, which is now something that science acknowledges, and how the sound can enliven that and wake it up. We also have stories about these three fires, the mind center in the brain, in the heart, and in the gut, and how bringing them into coherence actually opens a doorway to all knowledge from all time. And so when we think about the brain of humanity waking up, it's really about this enlivening of the potentiality that already exists within us, that we already carry. And I like to talk about that in the work that I do and relate it back to this concept of quantum phase transition, which is about, when enough cells within an organism have a change, there's a spontaneous change within the entire organism. So if we think about the body of humanity and where cells within the body of humanity, how changes within us individually will respond in the larger body of humanity as what I'm hoping will be a spontaneous remission. And so we are living in these challenging times of real accelerated movement, which often causes us to feel a bit overwhelmed. And when I look at all of the things that are going on around me, all of the individual cells within the body of humanity who are doing the real work to not only put out fires, but to actually address the elevation of their own consciousness and the elevation of their own vibrational frequency in this world of vibration and frequency, it gives me great hope. So I would like to have you talk a little bit about the power of self-transformation and the elevation of our own consciousness and vibrational frequency, and how that actually contributes to the awakening of the brain of humanity on a larger scale.
Sure. Well, you know, this very moment, and that's always paradoxical, because as soon as we think of the present moment, it's gone, and the next moment is with us, and our cognition of the now is always lagging the new arriving now, that in a way, all I can do to be here now is to open to the next new now, which is always arriving, always showing up. And if I can kind of draw myself out of the tiredness or discouragement or unconsciousness or numbness that would have me imagining that the next new now is nothing special, but if I could awaken into a recognition that this next new now is potentially a miracle, that you never know what will be here in the next new now, that all the beauty, all the joy, all the wonder, all the most inspiring and moving experiences that we could ever have are potentially right here in this next new now. And that if I can relax enough out of my all the different ways that the pains and wounds and traumas and suffering and discouragement of life have perhaps shut down my feeling, and I can find my way to a kind of innocence and a beginner's mind, as they call it in Zen, and open to the potential that this next new now could surprise me and be really all the glory and wonder and amazement that I could ever hope to experience, and get beyond my ideas about the now, and get beyond my all the habit patterns, and wake up into the astonished, heart-delighted wonder that actually opens to more and more and more of the miracle of the present moment, such that I might be here with reality itself and potentially with you as a, you might say, a priest, but not a priest because I know a lot or I have a lot of authority invested in me through a lineage or an institution, but a priest just in the sense that I'm right here directly noticing the miracle that every religion, that every enlightened master or every wise grandmother has ever imparted to anyone. If I could find my way here in the presence of that mystery and break open in joy and recognize that no matter how much of this mystery I'm noticing and being moved by, there's always more, so that I could break open in gratitude, so that I could fall open to the willingness to be of service, to celebrate this miracle, so that I could be with you, also a priestess of this wonder, and we could see these hearts that love and care in a way that allows the miracle of us just being here to blow our minds yet again. Well, you know, we're beginning to edge toward the disposition of a practitioner. The more we practice that wonder and that amazement, the more we bring it into about in future moments.
Terry, I want to just jump in there because I think that's a really that's kind of where the rubber starts meeting the road for me in terms of connecting the inner and the outer. But we are going to have to bow to the constraints of time for a short, brief station ID, and we'll be right back on that question in a minute. This week's Nonviolence Minute, we're going to share an excerpt from Terry Patton's book, A New Republic of the Heart, about the courage to be an activist. Terry writes, "Wherever we may be on the spectrum of activism, to become an activist takes courage. Activists are those who dare to go against the grain of what people are doing around them. They speak the truths that others do not want to hear. They defy the norm in service of a higher principle. Activism expresses a heroic impulse, but activists need not appear extraordinary. The values that inspire activism are the same values that drive the classic stories of literature, art, and popular entertainment. Everyone who begins as an underdog, or as an ordinary individual who leads an ordinary life, and then becomes challenged or moved to stand for higher values on behalf of a community or principle, is expressing the heroic qualities of the activist. These implicit values have been imparted via parables and stories and poetry to all of us from the time that we were children. Activism expresses fellowship, connection, relationship, a sense of brotherhood and sisterhood. When we act on our connectedness to others, we heal something essential in ourselves. We locate ourselves in something deeper than our postmodern alienation. Our connectedness in the service of larger things transcends the superficiality of many relationships and associations. In this era, when traditional communities and extended families are the exception, the community of like-minded and heart-based activists can be an essential healing and grounding force. This is all the more true because as activists we are, to a degree, voluntary outcasts from some elements of mainstream society. Activism is sometimes characterized as angry and strident, and sometimes it is. Sometimes anger is necessary and appropriate. Healthy anger has an essential function in advancing history. But anger tends to also summon fear, and it easily becomes destructive. Healthy activism is most fundamentally an expression of care rather than our anger. It is love in action." This full excerpt from A New Republic of the Heart, which goes on for a while longer, can be read at hopedance.org, another great website for heart-based activism. The link to this page can be found in our show notes on Podomatic, SoundCloud, and in our weekly email, which you can sign up for on my website, www.riverasun.com, on the Love and Revolution page. And now, let's return to speaking with Terry Patton about the spiritual practice and types of awarenesses needed for staying grounded while working for change in these chaotic times.
In a way, I'm saying some things that I have remembered that I know are true, but I'm mixing with them an attempt to actually be this and do this right here and right now with you, because that's what practice really is. It's a recognition that all those wise things that we knew or heard or said in some past moment that resonated are only as good as our ability to find our way into the reality they point to in the next new moment. And I think if we can be with each other in that way, that's a kind of prayer, a true prayer. And then we're in our brotherhood with the other creatures and the whole living earth. And there's a a way that everything we know about the mystery, everything we know about the wonder, everything we know about the problems and the crisis, everything we know about ourselves, everything we know about each other just drops away. Because we're not fundamentally knowers. We're feelers. We're hearts whose feeling capacity can include all kinds of thought and knowledge and all kinds of will and gut level vital knowing and intention, but who are at heart and intuitive. We're intuitions of love and infinity, finding our way into these bodies that that are mortal and that sometimes really hurt and that sometimes get confused.
So Terry, when we left off at the station ID, we were talking a bit about the inner practice and the inner transformation and how that is the ground and the foundation for outer practice or outer transformation. We had just talked about how, people are essentially intuitive. They're essentially want to be love-based people. But life kind of runs you through the ringer sometimes. You forget that sacred wisdom that all the traditions speak about. You get a little hardened. Your heart gets hurt. You might put up some armor. You might come out of legacies of traumas or legacies of privileges that are built on other kinds of crazy ideologies. And it all collides in our society, in our culture, in our education, in our economy, and in these crises that are popping up in almost every one of these spheres that we're facing. So I'm curious a little bit to get into the title of your book, The New Republic of the Heart. And, we've talked about the inner world a bit on the show, but what happens when you show up in the greater systems or the larger systems? In the book, you talk a little bit about the three aspects of evolutionary activism, working within the system, working around the system, and working against the system. And I'd love it if you could explain those three different things to the listeners and maybe speak a little bit about integrating both that inner world and how you show up with that intact in transforming these outer systems.
Sure. Well, if I'm not practicing in a fundamental way, if I've just gone dead to the joy in life, I'm really lost, and I'm going to tend to bring my unhappiness to others, to every moment, to everything I do. And so I can't really be a force for the values that I hold. So I have to practice. I have to practice to return myself to sanity and well-being, and I have to practice to return my relationships to sanity and well-being. And yet, if I'm awake to what's going on, I'm going to notice that there are all these systemic causes of suffering and destruction of Mother Earth, and I'm going to want to be effective in relation to those. And one of the main ways that we can affect that is by working within the systems that we have. Now, we have a very imperfect democracy in the United States, but at least we have something like a democracy, however rigged the system often seems to be, however unfair the dynamics, however pernicious the influence of money on politics might be. There are still ways that we can dig into it and we can have some impact. So I need to work within the system. It's a moral imperative that we vote in every election that we're allowed to vote in, because those are the ways that we can affect laws. If you were moved by those teenagers from the high school where there was the mass shooting who were demanding change, they were demanding legal changes about gun law. You're not going to have changes in gun law unless better people are elected. You've got to participate in the system. But that's not the only way to be active. And a lot of us recognize that there are so many systemic biases in the system that sometimes we have to just stand up against the injustices of the system. and we can have big impacts sometimes. I'm totally convinced that the many people who flooded to the airports when the first Muslim ban was suddenly imposed by the Trump administration in early 2017, I think a lot of Muslims saw that. They saw the goodness of those people. And individuals who might otherwise have begun to become radicalized and maybe persuaded toward a kind of violent Islamism were changed in their perception. That protest against the system was a big part of saying who we are as Americans. So it was hugely important. And so against the system activism is important, but it's often symbolic. You don't actually change laws by marching against the terrible environmental policies of the Trump administration and Scott Pruitt. You don't necessarily actually get tangible results. You only get that from in the system activism. On the other hand, that's not enough. Just working with laws and politics is only a small part of what our world has in it. There are all kinds of ways we can affect the future that have nothing to do with addressing the political system. We can go around the system. Most of my activism has been around the system activism, although I try to be an active activist in all three ways all the time. But, you know, actually taking care of a piece of land and demonstrating a different approach to forestry that allows a diverse ecosystem to thrive and still shows a way of managing that land that has some economic sense to it and that maybe even has long-term better economic results than the kind of violent, clear-cut forestry practices that have been dominant in my area, that's worth doing. It's worth educating girls. That's proven to be one of the most effective ways to change the future. But it doesn't have to do with anything that looks outwardly like activism. It looks more like, you know, social entrepreneurship or charity work or working in NGOs. Most of the NGOs in the world are finding ways to do tangible good without necessarily addressing system dynamics. If we could make fossil fuels non-competitive, we'd transform the world. But what would we look like? We'd look like entrepreneurs, social entrepreneurs, inventors, developers of new technology. All those things are ways we can change the future too. So I thought also that it was important to recognize that even when you change your diet, when you decide to not participate in the factory farming economy, you change the world in another way. So there are thousands of ways that every one of us is beginning to awaken to different kinds of actions that we can take that are part of how we vote with our feet for a different kind of future. The thing is, all of that activism is one aspect of a whole. The inner work and the outer work really can't be separated. Not only inner and outer, but inter, our interrelationships with each other. So finding ways to be deeper, truer practitioners, finding ways to, you know, no matter who you are, no matter how loving you might think you are, life is a journey, and it's a journey in which we're all learning to love, and nobody's ever perfected it. And so we're always learning to love better, deeper, truer, and we can keep learning to love deeper and truer and better. And that's kind of what we're doing. And if our communities of activism are communities in which we're learning to show up and to be love and to be friends, and to create community, and to become communities of practice, where every one of us is learning to be a better person, learning to enjoy the unaccountable grace of being alive in this miraculous world. If we're doing all of that at the very same time that we're protesting or registering people to vote or engaging in our NGOs goals and realizing them, then a different thing begins to happen, and we begin to find ourselves in a kind of paradoxical harmony, you know, in which it still hurts, life is difficult, but in which the miraculous joy of life is being shared by us with each other, even as we're getting older or getting sick or dying, and which we're becoming celebrating together more and more.
One of the things that really stood out for me, because I talk a little bit about shared agreement and how we have common agreements as societies that actually design the written and unwritten laws of the society. And you also talk about shared agreements in your book. And one of the things that you talk about under that section is this idea of commitment. And you have outlined a number of commitments that those who wish to create this kind of community of this evolutionary community, this new republic of the heart, that there are certain commitments that we have to take together. And I think if we look at the way that things have evolved over the last, you know, say 2 millennia, we can see all of the places where we have both clearly defined and then unspoken shared agreements as a species that have really shaped the way that we have evolved together. And when we're thinking about creating a new way of being, because one of the things that I was raised to believe, which is obviously very different from what you've come to believe, is that, you know, it's not a practice. What we're doing is not a practice. It's what we call Skijinawe Bamosawagan, which is a way of life, that we're actually living this way of life fully embodied, not in a segmented or fragmented way that's connected with, well, today I'm going to practice, which is not the way that you're talking about it either. But I think it's important to talk about this level of commitment to a way of life that is connected to this evolving new way of being that really is reaching back, you know, reaching back in some ways in order to claim our future that is more aligned with who we are at the core of our being. And so when we think about creating shared agreements, when we think about creating a new way of being in relation to one another and in relation to the rest of creation, you know, can you just talk about some of the commitments that you've outlined in the book that are related to that, that really are about these commitments are not checklist items. They're really about embodying a way of being that's in alignment with all of the things that you've been talking about.
Thank you. Yeah. Well, for me, even practice is an ongoing exploration. Like, it's not, even though I've written books about practice and I've taught thousands of people to take up a more integral practice, I don't think I know. What I know about practice is less important than my curiosity about practice. That showing up in a way that, you know, kind of has those eyes of a child, you know, who's seeing the wonder and possibility. So ways of being that it reflect wholeness are always imperfect, no matter who we are, no matter how rich our lineage tradition. The world is so out of balance. We're in such a crucial tipping point moment that whatever we know about how to practice is much smaller than what practice is now becoming, you know. And I like the word practice, but I like your word too, or just a way of life, like a healthy way of life, a way of life that embodies and celebrates wholeness. That's wonderful. And we have tremendous indigenous wisdom coming to us from the only people who've ever lived on this planet in a way that would be permanently sustainable over time. But even those ways have to make new discoveries in this critical time. Nobody, no elder, no enlightened being, no awakened master, no wise grandmother, nobody, nowhere is fully in possession of all the answers. We're in the presence of questions that are more profound than any of our answers. And so being together and being with ourselves in a way that's alive to that miracle and that and the profundity of this of this ask, it draws us into all the forms of wholeness that we do know, but it also has to draw us into a kind of open-hearted curiosity about new forms of wholeness beyond those that we know. And that's for me the thing I most would then want to point to and suggest. That's where I want to be with each of you. I want to be in the questions. You know, in the book I use this metaphor of a Japanese koan, this impossible question that's given to the Zen monk. And you can't go on in your career as a monk until you answer the question, but the question is just completely confounding. You know, and the famous koans that we hear about are questions like, what is the sound of one hand clapping? Well, I don't know how to answer that. Well, you know, the mind stopped, and yet you have to answer it. Well, how can you be health and wholeness in a world that seems like it's coming unraveled? How can you get beyond your what you do know and your anger and your hurt and your grief and your righteousness and really be a presence of love and clarity in the midst of this?
Isn't that really very core for these times? These times of great change, of great transition that, I mean, all of us, whether you're the president of the United States or you're a political activist or you're grounded mostly in your spiritual tradition, but you know you have to step outside of the Zendo to get in the streets, whatever it is, there's a lot of unknowns confronting us. That quality of being in the unknown is really like the hallmark of a time of great change. And so what I appreciate about what you just finished with was that we are in the unknown together, and that the mm-hmm. questions are more profound than the answers we might come up with right now, but the questions themselves are what guides us towards the world we want to create next, the world we want to help bring into being in the now, as you called it. But what encouraged me about your book is that you very clearly articulated that we're not alone on this path, that this new Republic of the Heart that you talk about is not unimagined altogether, that it actually is sprouting up in different places, like mushrooms after the rain, and that our participation within these communities of practice, within these movements for change, or within these ways of being in the world, helps to grow the very world we wish to see in our everyday lives. Could you share with the listeners some directions to go in if they're standing on the other side of that and wondering, how do I connect with like-minded people?
Wow, there's so many ways to go. I mean, certainly I hope that listeners will be intrigued enough by what I've had to say that many of them will get hold of a copy of my book from the library, if not buying one. And there are quite a few resources that I name, but there are many, many more beyond those that I was able to include. The most important thing is to find a way to live with heart, just in the moment, right now, even as you're hearing these words. Drop in, breathe to and from your heart, and feel from the heart. And let that intelligence of the heart be there, kind of providing a sanity and a center for whatever is next for you. And then feel from the heart where there is that heart resonance, and spend time with those people with whom you can share that wisdom and that impulse of the heart. And then consider if there are other ways that you come alive, where you have your particular unique gifts and talents, where your genius lies. My one-liner for how to be a an effective activist is to follow your heartbreak and your genius with your friends. But that has to be guided by, in a sense, your joy, by your humor, by your yes to life. So finding that yes, finding friends with whom you can do some things that make a difference. Maybe going to the resource section in my book, or there are many, many other people who are doing good work. Finding ways to work within the system, against the system, and around the system. But doing it in a way that brings your special capacities to bear. And knowing that you're in solidarity with the future of life and with everything that's good and true and beautiful in this world. And finding in the midst of that a way to open more and more and to act more and more decisively. Because there's love in you. And what our world now needs is love that can speak with a natural, inherent authority. Love that can command more authority than the voice that tries to instill fear in others. We tend to think that power comes from money and guns and lawyers and the installation of fear in others. But there's a deeper power. It's the power of the heart, and it's the natural authority that love has, which is far more authoritative, far more impactful than anger. Be that and do that. That's what I'd recommend.
Wonderful. We are listening. We are actually talking with Terry Patton about his book, A New Republic of the Heart, An Ethos for Revolutionaries. Terry, thank you so much for spending this time with us and for having this discussion with us and sharing your vision for a new path forward for us as human beings, and for encouraging our listeners to find their own way into the new republic of the heart. My gratitude for your time and for the work that you're doing in the world.
Well, thank you so much. I'm grateful to each of you for your passion. You clearly love life and love this earth with me. So thank you, sisters. Mm. We need each other.
Yes. Thank you so much.
I need you to be love, 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 love and revolution. Love, love,
love. Thanks this week to our guest, Terry Patton, who discussed with us his book, A New Republic of the Heart. You can find information on Terry's work on the podcast link. And I'd also like to thank my co-host, Rivera Sun, for helping to bring these engaging conversations to the airwaves with me each week. Our theme song, Love and Revolution, with words and music by Diane Patterson, and also performed by Diane Patterson and Spirit Radio, can be found at www.dianepatterson.org.
And thanks to you, Sherry, for sharing this conversation with Terry and I and bringing your overlapping interests to the radio waves with us. We have a Love and Revolution Radio Facebook page, so give us a like and you'll find the podcast links there to share with your friends. This radio program can be broadcasted on the regular old-fashioned airwaves of radio stations, and station managers are often really happy when you call them up and say, I have this great new podcast that you should put on your rotation. You can reach us via the Love and Revolution page on my website, www.riverasun.com. And if you're looking for us on Podomatic, Stitcher, iTunes, and SoundCloud now, you know what our name is by this point in the show.
For Love and Revolution Radio, I'm Sherry Mitchell. Like Rivera and I here on Love and Revolution Radio and in our other work in the world, Terry Patton asks you to use this time of extreme urgency and escalated growth to evoke your highest character and values, to shape a new form of activism that engages the heart and activates the spirit. Maybe you'll take some time to think about how you can make a no-matter-what commitment toward creating a new republic of the heart by the time we talk to you next week.
What if you knew?